The Path We Chose. Part 4. How We Got Here. Chapter 11. The Boom Before the Bust. Times were good, really good. Everyone was making money, and everyone was spending it. The result was unprecedented growth. In fact, the total wealth in the country more than doubled in fewer than 10 years. There were new technologies, and a new kind of media that allowed news and ideas to spread like never before. These were unprecedented times indeed. This was not the 1980s or the 1990s. This was the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. The period after World War I was the time when America first truly became a consumer society. For the first time in years, Americans were relatively wealthy, and with the wealth came good times. With all that disposable income, they were able to buy luxuries and new technologies, all the new inventions that could improve the quality of life. Electric refrigerators, telephones, cars, and movies all saw their introduction and rise in popularity during the 1920s. And let's not forget about new forms of media that were introduced. In 1920, there was one commercial radio station in the United States, KDKA out of Pittsburgh. 3 years later, there were over 500 stations across the country, and at the end of the decade, there were more than 12 million households with radios. This new national media allowed for news to be broadcast like never before. It also allowed for national advertising to be broadcast in a way that was previously impossible. Combined with the introduction of chain stores, the popularity of radio meant that people on one coast could now buy the same things as people on the other coast. And with the arrival of the movies, more and more media focused on the lives of movie stars and sports heroes. We dreamed of living glamorous lives like theirs. With national attention, celebrity was no longer a byproduct of success. It became a thing to achieve itself. Fame became a new way to achieve alpha status. It was a time of aspiration. Thanks to all these new technologies and modern conveniences, the period also gave rise to entirely new industries. Just like the internet created a need for IT consultants, the automobile created a need for gas stations, for example. It all sounds eerily reminiscent of our modern times. New technologies, new media, new industries, an obsession with the lives of celebrities, the increase of wealth and consumerism, and most significant, thanks to all that excess, a preponderance of waste. Then something happened. It all suddenly stopped. As much as people try to beat the laws of nature, there's always a correction. Nature abhors imbalance. Nothing can grow forever. And so despite the expectation of never-ending good times, on October 29th, 1929, it all came to a sudden and abrupt halt. Black Tuesday, as the crash was called, was a huge correction in the stock market. The weight of the imbalance and overvaluations had to, at some point, right itself and find balance again. Though corrections are not uncommon, in this case, the imbalance was so extreme that the correction was significant enough to start the Great Depression. A period marked by a loss of nearly 90% of the stock market's value and unemployment rates that left as many as a quarter of the country jobless. Unlike their parents, those born during most of the 1920s were too young to actually enjoy the 1920s. They were raised in one of the most austere times in American history. And, as our anthropology dictates, with resources scarce, the generation learned to work together and help each other make ends meet. Waste and excess just weren't an option anymore. The Depression lasted for over a decade and didn't end until nearly 1942. It was the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, that forced America into World War II and pulled it out of the Depression. The generation that grew up during some of the worst economic times in the country came of age just in time to be drafted and shipped off to do battle with Hitler's armies. The entire country went straight from the Great Depression into a Great War. By the time America entered World War II, the population of the United States was about 133 million, of which about 16 million marched off to war. That's about 12% of the population. Today, America's population is more than 315 million, and less than 1% serve in the military. That includes active duty, civilian, guard, and reserve forces. Of course, these are different times, and we're not involved in a world war, a war in which we would bear any burden or pay any price to protect what we believed in. During World War II, given the sheer volume of people who put on a uniform, nearly everyone knew someone who served in the military. Many parents watched their own sons march off to battle. Today, simply because most of us aren't friends with someone in the military, We have trouble understanding how people can maintain such a deep sense of selfless service. Unlike today's conflicts, World War II wasn't a war that happened at a distance. It wasn't viewed on television or on a computer screen. It was a war that touched the lives of most of the country. The entire nation was involved in the war effort. According to The War, the seminal World War II documentary by Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, 24 million people relocated to take defense jobs, and millions of women, African Americans, and Latinos found unprecedented opportunities in the workforce. Many others bought war bonds to help finance the war. Buying war bonds gave those who couldn't offer physical support the feeling that they too were a part of the effort. And for those who couldn't afford the war bonds, they contributed by planting victory gardens, growing fruit and vegetables to help reduce the burden of rationing. This is one of the reasons we call this generation the greatest generation. It was defined not by excess and consumerism, but by hardship and service. This was not a time when the country sat back and complained, pointed fingers, and debated if we should or should not be at war. This was a time when the whole country came together. According to a poll published in the November 1942 issue of Life magazine, over 90% of the country believed that America should keep fighting in the war. This was a population that overwhelmingly supported the draft before the war and continued to believe that military training should be compulsory after the war. As a nation, we believed in service. And nearly everyone, in some way, shape, or form, sacrificed and served for the good of each other. Nearly all Americans felt a part of something bigger than themselves. When the war was finally won, the men who survived the battles returned home to parades and parties. The celebration wasn't just for those who had risked their lives on the front lines. Rather, it was for all who had participated and sacrificed in their own way. Almost everyone shared the feeling of accomplishment and sense of relief that came with the Allied victory. As well they should have. They had worked hard for that feeling. They earned it. With the war behind them and the economy booming, the men and women of the greatest generation, those raised during the Depression, then sent off to war, felt that they had missed out on their youth. Many were even bitter. They felt that they had already spent so much of their lives sacrificing that they wanted to try to reclaim some of what they had lost. And so they got to work. The importance of hard work, the necessity of cooperation, and the value of loyalty, everything they knew about getting things done, defined how companies operated when this generation ran them. The 1950s were defined as an era of giving one's entire life to one company, and of one company expecting their people to work there for their entire lives. At the end of a long career, an employee would receive their proverbial gold watch, the ultimate symbol of gratitude for a life of service to the company. And it worked. For a while. The 800-pound boomer in the room. Every generation seems to confound or rebel against the generation before it. Each new generation embodies a set of values and beliefs molded by the events, experience, and technologies of their youth, which tend to be a little different from those of their parents. And when the populations grow at a steady pace, the push and pull between the generations, the impulse of a new generation to change everything, and the desire of an older generation to keep things the same work like a system of checks and balances. It offers a natural tension that helps to ensure we don't break everything while also allowing us to make progress and change with the times. One point of view or a single uncontested power is rarely a good thing. Like the visionary and the operator inside a company, Democrats and Republicans in Congress, the Soviets and Uncle Sam in geopolitics, even mom and dad at home. The value of two opposing forces, the tension of push and pull, actually keeps things more stable. It's all about balance. But something happened at the end of the Second World War that upset the normal system of checks and balances. A break in the natural order that would quite literally, and quite by accident, set America on an entirely new course. Returning from war, people celebrated. And celebrated, and celebrated. And 9 months later, there began a period of population growth never seen before in the United States, the baby boom. In 1940, there were 2.6 million children born. In 1946, the number of children born was 3.4 million. There was a small boom at the end of World War I, but it was the massive spike in births that began after World War II that tipped the balance. A disparity that was compounded by the relatively slow birth rate during the Depression and the war. The end of the boomer generation is typically regarded as 1964, The year the number of births dipped below 4 million for the first time in more than a decade. All told, the boomers added 76 million people to the population, a growth rate of nearly 40%, compared to a less than 25% increase between 1964 and 1984. And the dramatic change doesn't stop there. Unlike their parents, who were raised during a time of economic depression and war rations, the boomers were raised in times of rising affluence and prosperity. Starting at the end of the war, wealth and GDP in America did nothing but grow at a steady pace. This was a good thing for all those boomers. The parents who fought or sacrificed were now able to give their children a life completely opposite to their own. Whereas the greatest generation was defined by the needs to serve others, the boomer generation started on a path of taking for themselves. As our wealth and attitudes changed, we started to transform from a country that would fight to protect a way of life into a country that would fight to protect the way we prefer to live. Growing up under the protection of their newly wealthy parents, the first group of boomers became teenagers in the 1960s. And, like all good teenagers, they rebelled against their parents' push for them to work hard and devote themselves to a job or a company until they got that gold watch. They rejected the quiet suburbs and their parents' focus on material wealth. Leave It to Beaver was not their idea of the good life. Individualism, free love, and narcissism were. In 1960s America, however, the hippies who chose to live a life with less than they needed did so for the simple fact that as a country, we had more than we needed. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the greatest generation was perfect. In fact, they had some serious problems. At the same time that Americans were saving the world from the tyranny of Nazism, they were struggling with issues of racism and inequality. The American dream was the picture of harmony, as long as you were white, Christian, and male. Back in the U.S., women were still considered unqualified for public life or the executive suite. African Americans wouldn't be embraced as full citizens until the Civil Rights Act of 1964, nearly 20 years after the war had ended. And even then, it passed with nearly 30% of the Senate voting against it. When the boomers were young, it was they who forced the civil rights on an older generation bent on maintaining an unhealthy and unjust status quo. It was indeed the young boomers who demanded better pay for women and refused to blindly accept the injustices that prevailed in our society. They might have become the second greatest generation had they continued on that path, but that's not how it went. As the disproportionately large generation of boomers started aging, they changed course. And that's when our modern era problems started to arise. The maturing boomers, as a generation, started to operate in different ways, in more selfish ways. They now set out to protect the world with which they were most familiar, the world of rising wealth and affluence. By the 1970s, the older boomers were now graduating from college and starting to make their way into the workforce. In a decade marked by an unpopular war and the Watergate scandal, Richard Nixon seemed to offer a foreboding look at the generation he served. His own selfish ambitions drove decisions that were at best unethical and at worst illegal. The boomers witnessed events that only reinforced their early beliefs that government can't be trusted, we have to look out for ourselves, and we need to change the way things are done. Forget the status quo, the boomers aspired to self-realization. Having a spiritual guru was like going to the gym today. They learned to disco, they wore polyester, and they sealed their reputation as the generation that defined, as Tom Wolfe described in a 1976 issue of New York Magazine, the Me Decade. They became a group that seemed to be more concerned about their own happiness and well-being than the happiness or well-being of those around them. As the generation grew older and started to enter the workforce, making their own contribution to our economy, they brought all this self-centeredness and cynicism with them. Except, in this case, there were vastly fewer of the previous generation to balance the ideals of this new me-before-we generation. The late 70s also saw the introduction of new theories about how to conduct business. Shaken by the Vietnam War, a presidential scandal, an oil crisis, the rise of globalization, and near the end of the decade, a revolution in Iran that involved American lives, economic theories became more protectionist in nature. They tended to focus on how to safeguard our rising wealth rather than to share it or use it to support causes of national importance, like the war bonds of earlier generations. Service to others, as part of our national identity, was slowly being replaced by service to ourselves as a national priority. Throughout this time, America's household affluence continued to skyrocket. Gross domestic product grew from $3.87 trillion in 1965 to 4.7 trillion in 1970 to 6.52 trillion in 1980. That's 68% growth in 15 years. It looked like a steep slope up with barely a bump in the road. We were getting wealthier and wealthier, as individuals and as a country. Though the wealthiest Americans were getting wealthier at a disproportionately higher rate than the rest of the country, even the poorest Americans at least stayed the same or even rose by a small degree. The point is, no segment of the population got significantly poorer. With the 1970s coming to a close, Americans started to replace their bell-bottom jeans with members-only jackets and to rip up their shag carpeting. The baby boomers were finally coming of age. They started to work at more senior levels at companies and in government. The coddled boomers, the ones who didn't have to suffer much, the ones who grew up in a society that could afford for them to put themselves first, were now starting to take positions in which they could affect political, business, and economic theory en masse. It's worth noting that it was when the boomers arrived that relationships in Congress really started to suffer. Until the early 1990s, members of the opposing parties, while still prone to the same theatrics they are today, were able to sit down together with the goal of reaching a compromise. They may not have agreed, but they tried. And for the most part, they behaved with civility. Their children went to school together, and their families knew each other. They even socialized on weekends. And as a result, Congress functioned. The boomer generation would emerge bigger and more powerful than any opposing force that could help keep things in check. Without a balancing tension, the impulses and desires of one group would prove hard to restrain. Like the unchecked power of America after the fall of the Soviet Union, like the dictator who overthrows his predecessor, like legislation passed when one party has a supermajority in Congress, the boomers would start to impose their will on the world around them, surrounded only by outnumbered voices telling them they couldn't. By the 1980s and the 1990s, this shockwave, this pig in the python, as the baby boom is sometimes described because of its sheer size and force, this demographic bulge able to remodel societies they passed through it, was fully in charge.